It's the Rational Compassion edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, part two of our interview with Nigerian skeptic Lee Ligwe, Rogers and the Right to Deceive, and Neanderthals. Where do they go and how do they get there? Let's begin episode 156.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords in politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of smart stuff. We are aware. The cosmos can know itself.
The sea of space, the stars, our mother, we have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello, and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher speaking. Ethan, we had some trouble over last week's show.
Yeah, so listeners may have noticed some technical problems with the podcast. If you downloaded it from our podcast feed, you would have gotten about an hour of silence. Now, normally we have talking on our show, as most people know. So that would be a real disappointment had you downloaded the episode. Now, the problem was traced back to the CITR studios, where we got some wires crossed, and several other shows here on the station had similar problems. However, if you would like to get the version of episode 155 with sound, and of course you do, head over to www.readingthinker.com, check out the show notes for episode 55, and you can download the actual episode with sound and everything.
Cool, cool. You know, you say it was a slight accident, but I bet you there was some kind of conspiracy involved. And on that note, I'm letting people know that in a coming episode, we're going to be doing a whole series about conspiracy theory. But in the meantime, Ethan, don't be afraid.
Yes.
You might want to sit down for this. Zombies are real. Okay, well, not technically real yet, but Andre Ford at the Royal College of Art in UK has developed a sort of project. He's more of a avant-garde artist, but he's developed a way of farming chickens that is both ethical and productive. It's a proposal so far, but the idea is that you breed chickens in such a way so as to eliminate their higher functions. Essentially, you're stripping out the cerebral cortex of it. This would be done sort of like a birth defect that happens naturally to some poor chickens as it is, but they cannot feel pain. You have enough of the brain, simply enough to breathe and pump the heart. So there's no ethical issues about hurting animals. But because they are now sort of more like a plant than they are like an animal, you literally can sort of do the matrix treatment on it, right? So you have them hanging from pods in a factory sort of setting where they grow, and the muscles themselves are sort of developed through electro stimulation, so it'll taste and feel like real meat. It won't be some attribute thing like you see on all those bad movies. But the idea is that this could increase production of poultry by 48%, and it will reduce greenhouse gases because of livestock emissions by over 18%. So it seems like a really interesting and bizarre way of dealing with one of those ethical issues we have, you know, veganism versus meat eating, and how are we going to feed the growing number of people on the planet?
Well, it certainly is an intriguing idea. I mean, in this particular case, it might not be exactly a real science just yet, but it is an intriguing idea. I mean, I've heard similar things about sort of growing human organs as well that are just sitting in some kind of laboratory. And, the question being here is, if these things don't have brains and nervous systems and, you know, the attributes that we normally would imply them sentience, is there sort of a moral problem with, you know, harvesting organs, or in this case, growing chickens like plants, essentially? So an interesting dilemma, or I don't know, maybe it's not a dilemma. I don't know. I think I'd be pretty okay with eating a chicken that didn't have a brain. I mean, frankly, chickens aren't that smart to begin with. But yeah, I mean, it is kind of an interesting question, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, you know, and like I say, the person who's developed Andre is, again, more of an architect sort of thing, right? So he sort of designed the mechanics of how you would actually set up the factory, which I think is one of the things that's often overlooked, because people tend to worry about the biology of it and not how do you actually set this up in a real world. I think the one thing, though, that will be his Achilles heel is I don't see anywhere in the write-ups that I've been reading any note about infections, and I could see losing a few crops because of this.
Well, yeah, and I mean, you also have to wonder, like, just how dependent is the health of these somewhat plant-like chickens going to be impacted if they don't have a functional brain? Like, will their immune systems even work properly? Or, you know, if they get some kind of, like, infection going through them all, how will we, you know without having any kind of observable symptoms?
Also making a bit of a dig here, or some people are who are supporting this, is that, you know, we often promote things like free-range chicken and that sort of thing as somehow more ethical. And I guess in some ways it is, but I mean, you're still ultimately, you know, killing an animal, right? The only thing you've really done is with that label, as a consumer, I no longer feel as bad for enjoying my succulent chicken, right? Whereas this would circumvent that and just be uneconomical. As they say, I'm not sure how much money you would lose by losing a crop of chickens, but bird flu does that all the time.
Well, it does remind me, actually, of another podcast, the Ricky Gervais Show podcast, and they had a conversation on that show about whether or not it's better to eat free-range chickens or, you know, sort of the factory-farmed ones, and the argument being that, well, it's more sort of merciful to eat the factory-farmed ones because they're having a miserable life, and they're probably going to, you know, look forward to death. Whereas the free-range chickens are having a great life, they're free-range, they're eating corn, and then you kill them and eat them. It just seems like kind of cruel, you know?
Maybe what the chickens need is they need some sort of support mechanism to help them deal with all this pain and suffering. Something like, I don't know, the church. It's my clever segue into another study that I've read the other day. I think we've covered on our show before, and people have probably read before, there are a number of studies in the past that show that people who are regular church attenders tend to have lower rates of mental illness and depression. And, of course, we have often explained that away by saying that, well, you know, there is a support group. It's not so much the religion itself as if you were involved in a bowling team, you'd get similar effects. Well, this research points to another reason why this may be occurring is the fact that people are sort of self-selecting themselves out of the church going. This study involved 2,100 Americans going from birth to middle age, and it found that, at least in women, most of the people who developed depression dropped out of the church cycle before they were age 18. So by the time they were in their 20s and 30s, they were out of the church, and then their depression sort of hit in. It's one of those things that maybe it's not so much that the church helps prevent depression, but those people who are prone to depression are also people not likely to go to church. Oddly enough, it pointed out that there was no link for this between men and depression. It was only in women.
Well, that is interesting, isn't it? Well, I mean, the question I think becomes is how can you determine the sort of, to go back to the chicken thing, chicken and the egg question about do depressed people kind of just not go to church, or is the church activity having an effect on the depression?
Well, again, from what this study was saying is that if the church was going to be an important aspect of it, at least, again, from this perspective, it is people who are prone to depression don't go to church. So they don't go to the church first, and then, of course, because these depressed people aren't in the church, or the majority of them, then it seems like less people are getting depressed in church itself, which wasn't so much the church, but the people who selected not to go to church in the first place. Can I make that clear?
Yeah, absolutely. That's perfectly clear.
We try to be clear, don't we?
We try to be clear, very clear, yes, very clear.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things, as you point out, you know, it's cause and effect. And even if, like, one of the things I thought was interesting about this particular aspect is it didn't affect men. And I think maybe that may be pointing to, I mean, we know in an obvious sort of way that there are a lot of differences between women and men in their biology. And perhaps, again, the aspects of psychology works differently for that. I mean, women tend to be seen more as social animals. And if there's something wrong with their psychic makeup, that may be showing up in this way as well.
Well, I mean, it sounds even sociological as well. I mean, obviously, the religious institutions, most of them have a sort of a subservient role for women within them. So, you know, maybe there is some kind of impact on the way that organized religion sort of treats men and women that would generate depression in women but not in men. I mean, maybe it's seen as more of a social faux pas for a woman to be, you know, not welcome in a church than it is for a man, perhaps.
Well, I'm also thinking, too, that, you know, going to a church itself is largely a social act. And depression itself is quite often manifest as a retraction from society. I mean, people who are depressed tend to be very secluded, very antisocial in their nature. And maybe this is just a precursor to that. You know, the selecting not to be a member of this one particular social group is just saying, hey, you know, I've got a sniffle. I bet you're going to have a cold later. Hey, I'm not joining the social group. Maybe I'm going to be a recluse and depressed later.
It is entirely possible.
So, we're going to be back to a commercial, and we're going to talk about your right to deceive people, or at least the corporation's right to deceive people.
Hello, this is Leo Igwe, Nigerian skeptic, global humanist, and a tireless opponent of witch hunting. Help promote skepticism and rational thinking by listening to Radio Free Thinker, CITR Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver, Canada. I remember that as skeptics and free thinkers, we don't need skepticism or free thinking. The world needs skepticism and free thinking.
And we're back here on Radio Free Thinker. So, Don, what's up with Rogers and their fight for truth?
Rogers is using a charter claim to fight truth in advertising law. Rogers Communication is asking the Ontario court to strike down part of the federal law requiring a company to have, quote, adequate and proper test of product performance before advertising claims about the product on the grounds that it violates freedom of expression. In addition to taking on the performance claim provision of the Competition Act, the telecom giant is also arguing before the Supreme Court that the hefty penalty that can be imposed on the company is also unconstitutional. The legal battle with Rogers began in November 2010 when the Bureau went to court to levy a $10 million penalty for a misleading advertising campaign involving the company's charter discount phone service. The Bureau is also asking the court to order Rogers to pay restitution to affected customers and refrain from engaging in similar campaigns in the next decade. Of course, that lasts a little bit. Refrain from having false advertising campaigns in the next decade. I'm sure they know what they're talking about. In their advertising, Rogers Charter claimed to have fewer dropped calls than any other competitor, and its customers had, quote, no worries about dropped calls. A study of dropped call rates between Rogers Charter and the competition showed there was no difference in the rates. The ruling in question in the competition law states that before a company can make an advertised claim, it must have a test in hand. Rogers is claiming this violates its charter of free speech because, and you may want to sit down for this one, if what it had said was true when they said it, but they didn't have the proof, but later could provide proof, then the test would be a violation because it would prevent them from saying a true thing because they did not know at the time it was true. Make sense to you? No, not me either. First, the case at hand shows they issued a false and misleading statement. So, prima facie, they're probably going to lose this one. But secondly, they are saying that if there is no proof to the contrary, they can claim anything, and that to prevent them from making that claim would be a violation of its charter right. Not that I think corporations have charter rights in the first place, but that's another show. Another aspect that plays into this is the amount and type of penalty. First, it's not a fine, which is given in criminal courts. Penalties are handed down by civilian courts. The civilian court is also not subject to the same sort of safeguards criminal cases are, such as presumption of innocence, right to a fair trial, to make full answers in defense, and the privilege against testimonial compulsion. Although here, with the exception perhaps of the last point, the compulsory testimony, I don't think Rogers is seriously implying that our courts are corrupt and thus they didn't get a fair trial or that there was no presumption of innocence. It is true the threshold of a guilty verdict is preponderance of evidence as opposed to the classic beyond a reasonable doubt, which I think is why they really are trying to push this aspect of the law and trying to make it seen as a criminal law as opposed to civil law. it would be almost impossible to prove that Rogers and the thousands of people working in it purposely misled the people. They would say it was a miscommunication or something like that. Now, this is important for Rogers because in 2010, the penalty for this infraction went from a paltry $250,000 to $10 million for the first event and $15 million for each one thereafter. Now, you may ask, why is Rogers pursuing this, these aspects in this case, especially free speech one, because they've been proven wrong. I mean, what they said was false. Well, what they want is a precedent. So even if they lose the case on facts, the precedent will be established that they do not actually have to prove a claim when they make the claim. And that's where it becomes quite interesting. If they win this case, in the future they will be able to make claims in their advertisements without actually knowing if those claims are true or not. Now, this is where a skeptic step in. I think the important aspect for our community, above and beyond one's view as a corporation, is we have often railed against the false or unsubstantiated claims made by groups like Naturopath, Classic Wu Medicine, your pseudoscientific Lim-Flam. All these things would become a charter right for them to say if Rogers succeeds in its challenge. There will be no need for them to actually have proof that the claims they are making are true. And that strikes me as a very scary aspect for us. What do you think, Ethan?
Well, I mean, it's shocking on a couple of levels. On one point, I mean, Rogers seems to be saying that they don't want to be held accountable for anything that they say, ever, because they may in some universe be right. So, I mean, if Rogers wanted to say, for example, that every 5 seconds everything in the universe doubles in size, they should be free to say so. Now, I mean, it's sort of like a meaningless statement, of course, but when it comes to making claims about their products, that's a whole different ballgame. And the potential outcome of this is that they would basically be immune from penalty for making any statement whatsoever about any of their services. Because, maybe their cell phones or whatever have the fewest drop calls. Maybe they don't, but maybe someday they will have the fewest drop calls, so it's okay to make that statement even though it's not technically true. These are all, I think, really important issues, and it's quite shocking, actually, that this is even being discussed. I mean, surely, our legal experts in this country realize the sort of ludicrousness of even this conversation.
It's not just Rogers. Is evil corporation. Everyone knows my stance on that. But if they set this precedent, this will be used by other groups that are not your corporate sort of entities. You'll have things, like I say, a chiropractor who says, listen, this treatment I'm offering you will align your chi and improve your immune system. And you can make that claim without actually having any sort of proof at all. I mean, the laws in this area itself are already pretty weak, and this would make it a charter right to say those kind of things. It just puts it on an entirely different level.
Right. Well, it comes down to this notion of, being free to say scientifically impossible statement. Or really, what it comes down to is should you have the freedom to claim things that we know to be scientific impossibilities? And I mean, I guess in some levels, we don't really want to be locking people up for saying stupid things. But if you're trying to sell something and you're using, misleading information, then that certainly seems like it's a case for consumer protection agencies to step in and, prevent that sort of thing.
I would agree. I would agree with you on that. Speaking of stepping in, when we return from our commercial break, we are going to have part two of our interview with Leo Igwe, where he talks about rational compassion and what it means to be a skeptic. Stay tuned.
March 8th is International Women's Day, observed since the early 20th century to celebrate women's solidarity in the fight for equal economic, social, and political rights. Here at CITR, we are celebrating all things female with a 24-hour marathon dedicated to women's issues and, of course, women in music. Tune in March 8th for your local and independent source for International Women's Day programming.
Rosie, Rosie, Rosie the Riveter.
Hello, listeners. Last week, we had part one of our interview with Liu Igwe, where we discussed witch hunting in Africa and how we can help to stop it. For those who missed last week's show or forgotten, Liu Igwe is Nigerian skeptic, global humanist, and tireless proponent of rational compassion. He's here today in our Radio Freethinker virtual studio, a former representative for Western and Southern Africa on the International Humanist and Ethical Union. Currently, he's pursuing a research program on witchcraft accusation in Africa at the University of Beirut in Germany, where we've caught up with him today. Welcome back, Leo.
Yeah, thank you, Don.
Now, many of us here in Canada don't think about Nigerians as skeptics. More often, it is, you know, financial difficulties of Nigerian princes that come to mind. In Canada, skepticism can either be a bad thing, for example, climate change denial, or a good thing. You're an advocate of the good kind. Tell me what skepticism means to you.
For me, skepticism is a method of inquiry, a way of evaluating claims and beliefs. Skepticism is a form of outlook, an outlook informed by reason and critical thinking. Skepticism is a way of thinking that helps me to address issues that border on deception, manipulation, and exploitation.
You've also described yourself as a humanist. Is there a difference between being a skeptic and being a humanist?
Well, I'm wondering if one can really be thoroughly a humanist, if there's anything like that, without being a skeptic. In the sense that being a humanist, I'm committed to humanity, I'm committed to human upliftment. And we know that very often beliefs informed by supernaturalism, beliefs which we call superstition, informed by fear and ignorance, are often being used to undermine humanity. They cause a lot of suffering in societies across the world, including in Nigeria, my own country, and in Africa, my own continent. So why skepticism helps me to remain sane within, in a society rather, where there's a lot of insanity, a lot of superstition. Humanism drives me to take care of other people who are suffering, who are exploited, often in the name of superstition, in the name of the supernatural, in the name of illusions and misconceptions being marketed and promoted by organizations, agencies, often adjudged as religious or spiritual.
So you would sort of say then that skepticism is a method and humanism is sort of the purpose to which you put it.
Yes. While skepticism will help me in addressing and evaluating a particular claim, humanism helps me also in trying to help those who suffer, sometimes not as a result of their own fault, but because they found themselves in situations or communities where lack of skepticism is really the case.
How did you become a skeptic, or more appropriately, how did you avoid the traps of supernatural thinking?
Well, I was brought up in a society where there was, and there's still a lot of supernatural thinking. But as I was growing up, I had this curious tendency. I was asking a lot of questions, and people were not really giving me very convincing answers. They were telling us about spirits that were moving around in the night, and I never saw any. And I was shocked that you can live in an environment during the day there are no spirits, nobody will talk about spirits. But whenever it gets dark, they make you to understand that there are spirits around. They make you to understand that when people die in communities, there are people that kill them, or that there are witches and wizards, there are evil magic, evil spirits. And there were so many of these claims which I was questioning when I was growing up, and nobody was ready to give me a very sound answer. Not just that there were many of these claims, people were also suffering as a result of that. People were being persecuted just based on mere suspicion of witchcraft, or mere suspicion that they have or they had magical thinking. So I was driven by curiosity, and as I was going to school, I was questioning these beliefs, and I found out that they were all nonsense. They were superstitious, and they were beliefs informed by fear and ignorance. They were beliefs causing suffering, a lot of suffering to many people, particularly those not educated, the vulnerable members of the population, women, children, and the aged. I was so moved because my skepticism made me to understand that these were baseless beliefs. So people were suffering. Needlessly, there was no need for people to suffer, people to be tortured and killed based on suspicion of magic, evil magic as they say, or witchcraft. So that's how I came about being a skeptic, and that's how I came about, you know, doing the work I've been doing, both as a skeptic and as a humanist.
You suffered a lot for your beliefs. Like I say, you've been beaten, arrested, threatened. Why do you continue? What has made this your personal, if I may use the term, crusade?
Well, I think that it's difficult for me to, you know, to say, because I don't think that was a place I just planned and said, this is what I'm going to do. Like, I just went to Helen Opabio's website and I found out she was coming to the U.S. I said, what? This cannot happen. Immediately, I did a statement, used the poster, sent it to friends around the world. I said, look, stop this woman now. I never planned that last year. You get it? So I just have a feeling that, look, when I feel strongly and I look at this thing, I find out that this thing is not going to be good for children in the U.S., children around the world. It's not going to be good for the process of enlightenment in the world. I do something about it. And sometimes such a thing will just spread and people will join and get many people supporting it and all that. What I'm saying is this. I just do what I think is right or what I think should be done. And I have a feeling that the world will not change on its own. Some people will change the world. Africa will not change on its own. Africans will change Africa. I don't believe in miracles. I believe that anything that comes to me or is something that I worked hard for or something that somebody worked hard for. So if we need a better world, we must be ready to work to realize a better world. And we must be ready to pay the price. All the good things we're enjoying today, scientific discoveries, the values of enlightenment in terms of institutions that promote reason and science and critical thinking, they did not come down like manna from heaven. Some people worked to realize that. So, being a skeptic and knowing the dishonesty, the dark and destructive influence being caused by baseless irrational beliefs, I am moved to see if I could make the world experience what I call skeptical care. That is the care only those who seek evidence can express in the world. Or what I call rational compassion. Compassion as a result of people who know the pain and agony people around the world go through as a result of irrationalism. As I'm talking to you now, people are rioting in Afghanistan and killing others because some pages of the Quran was mistakenly burned. It is madness. Human life and the pages of Quran, which one is more valuable? I feel so shocked that in this 21st century, people are still suffering and dying as a result of irrational, superstitious beliefs, sometimes under the guise or in the name of religion. And I think that I will not be very happy if I just die keeping quiet. Let me speak out. Maybe some people somewhere might get some hope as a result of that. Like a few children I've been able to rescue and all that. And they try to shine the light on the problems in different countries. And some changes are happening like in Malawi, in Gambia, and in other countries where we are working to promote and enlighten people. So, that is it. I am glad that maybe some kind of progress we're experiencing it. There's still a whole lot of work to be done. But I believe that if we are going to move further, then it will be from where we are today. So, that is my inspiration. If at the end of it all, this one leads now to defines an era where more and more people are liberated from the yoke of shackles of superstition and irrationalism, I'll be very happy. But even if it doesn't happen, I'll be happy that I have done my best. After all, I'm just one person out of billions of people around the world. So, but I'm experiencing some progress. And I hope that the progress will continue and that more people will join from around the world to save humankind from the shackles of superstition and irrationalism.
Thank you for your time, Mr. Gray, and for bringing sharp focus to our listeners about the problem of witch hunting, the problem of fundamental religion, and the need to promote skepticism, humanism, and religion, rational compassion, I love that word, in the global community. Is there any last words you'd like to tell our listeners?
Well, my last word is this. Those who are rationally minded, those who are skeptically minded, those who have managed to free their thoughts and free their minds. You know the value. You know the joy. I think we are obliged to share that joy with others. There are people who are suffering today. For instance, in Saudi Arabia, just in December, a woman was beheaded for witchcraft and sorcery. In September, another person was beheaded there. We need to speak out. A lot of people need the help of rational, free-thinking people around the world. Since we understand the value, we understand the joy of being free, speaking freely. We understand the joy of being rationally minded. And we understand the pain and agony people suffer as a result of unreason. I think that we are obliged to become proactive and reach out to the rest of the world. They need not be, these people need not to be skeptics like us. We're already here. So we're the treasure for the world. They need not to be atheists. But as long as people are suffering in Africa, in Asia, in Saudi Arabia, in Iran, in Nepal, in India, as a result of irrationalism, I think that those of us who understand the values, the joy, the exuberance, the excitement, the freedom that comes with the skeptical outlook, we can go out and reach out to the world. So for me today, I'm looking at skepticism for the world, not skepticism for skeptics. I'm looking at free thinking for the world, for humanity, not free thinking for free thinkers. And free thinkers do not need free thinking. The world needs free thinking. Skeptics do not even need the skeptical care. It is the world that needs the skeptical care. Rationalists do not need the rational compassion as such. It is the world that needs this. Children that are suffering as a result of rationalism that need this. Women, aged people that are being killed as a result of rationalism. They are the world that need this, our much valued rational compassion. Let's strive and extend that to them. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
This is Phil Plait of BadAstronomy.com, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM for UBC in Vancouver, British Columbia.
And we're back here on Radio Free Thinker. So obviously our thanks to our guest, Leo Igwe, and his interview with us. So let's go on to an interesting topic here, and something that's been in the news a little bit, and I think has been out there in the skeptic science-loving community for a while now, and that is the recent news about our quote-unquote cousins, the Neanderthals, who lived between 600,000 and 350,000 years ago, and went extinct sometime between 30,000 years ago to 25,000 years ago. When you're dealing with things that happened this long into the past, you kind of have to use a wide margins when it comes to pinpointing their exact time frame. Now, we've talked about some of the news and discoveries about Neanderthals in the past, including the possibility that humans, Homo sapiens, and Neanderthals may have interbred. There's also some new information emerging about our extended family tree. Not only have we learned about the so-called hobbits on Flores, the Denisovians in Siberia, and Neanderthals in Eurasia, but that for a fair stretch of time, all these species existed at the same time, which is pretty exciting, I think. There are still a lot of questions to be answered, however, but fortunately for our curiosity, some of them are being answered. One of the long-standing debates is what happened to the Neanderthals. Some have speculated that they went extinct because of increased competition from humans. Others have suggested that it was a change in climate. Well, there's been some recent research done, and what we've uncovered is quite telling. DNA analysis have suggested that Neanderthals in Western Europe died out as early as 50,000 years ago, which is thousands of years before Homo sapiens appeared on the scene. Now, if this is true, how was it that human beings and Neanderthals may have interbred? Well, the idea here is that a small group of Neanderthals survived their extinction and recolonized parts of Europe, surviving for about 10,000 years before vanishing.
And so you said they went extinct, but they didn't go extinct?
They sort of declined and then came back for a little while and then died again. So they're sort of like Jesus. So in a paper published in the Journal of Molecular Biology and Evolution, lead study writer Love Dalen from the Swedish Museum of Natural History in Stockholm has extracted DNA from bones of 13 different Neanderthals. And they were able to trace the genetic markers in here and came to some interesting conclusions. The fossil specimens came from Europe and Asia and span a time period ranging from 100,000 years ago to about 35,000 years ago. The scientists found that West European fossils with ages older than 48,000 years ago, along with Neanderthal specimens from Asia, show considerable genetic variation. So the idea here being is that there was a lot of diversity within the Neanderthal population before the sort of decline of the Neanderthals. After the decline, though, the population that did survive in Europe, that sort of recolonized for about 10,000 years, was a lot less genetically diverse, meaning it was a smaller population, isolated, and didn't have that ability to get greater diversity by having, you know, more people around to reproduce with. So the takeaway conclusion here is that Neanderthals were already in considerable decline before human beings showed up, perhaps even on the verge of extinction. I mean, you can think about it, a population that could survive for 10,000 years. I mean, you think, well, that's a long time, but in the grand scheme of things, it's not that long a time. In sort of a relatively isolated area of Europe, that's not that difficult from an evolutionary point of view. So we could be looking at a very small population of Neanderthals that survived this, you know, great decline. And then when humans came around, perhaps they were competing for resources, perhaps they were interbreeding, and some of them survived by breeding with humans, others were driven to extinction by the competition and whatever else led to their final extinction. So it does give us a bit of information about, you know, what actually happened to these Neanderthals.
It does also go along with the theory about how humans are the harbinger of death wherever they seem to show up. I mean, a lot of people know that as soon as humans seem to have shown up in North America, all the megafauna, you know, the woolly mammoths, the woolly rhino, all the big cats and that disappeared. And often it's sort of pointed that we did it, but new evidence is showing that we may have been that extra push off the cliff, but they were teetering on the cliff in the first place. And it seems like that this is sort of showing a similar event occurring for the Neanderthals.
Well, yeah, absolutely. The question, of course, that many of us are asking is, well, what caused the initial decline in the Neanderthal population around 50,000 years ago? Not surprisingly, it might have been climate change, which I think should set off a few red flags. Not red flags as in this is crap, but red flags as in, you know, let's take a look at what's happening around our own planet. But nevertheless, climate change, the idea here is that the Ice Age was ending around this time period, and that Neanderthals were probably pretty adapted to living in that kind of environment, but when the Ice Age declined, and, you know, the climate started to warm up, they were less adapted, and they were unable to survive in large numbers during this point, which may have explained why a small pocket of them was able to survive. If they had migrated to some place where their climate remained similar, perhaps they migrated north, then they may have survived there. While their populations that stayed in sort of southern Eurasia were unable to survive. As human beings moved out of Africa and started to colonize into Eurasia, they would have eventually come into contact with Neanderthals, maybe not right away because they're further north, but after a certain amount of time, they start to come into contact with them. And, you know, now we have this situation where some of them will be competing and some of them might be cooperating with humans. The interesting question is, for large periods of time, these different species all coexisted. And it's interesting to think about how, you know, these species interacted and are sort of a tidbit of Neanderthal and early humans interacting indicates that there was cooperation and there was competition. So, I mean, it does lead us to wonder what kind of interactions we had with the other species, like the Devonians and the so-called, you know, hobbits. And the interesting with the hobbits, of course, they're not really called hobbits, but I like using that word, is that they may have lived the longest out of all of our so-called cousins. And, you know, So human beings may have had significant interaction with them. I think, I mean, because the Devonians are sort of the newest discovery, I guess you could say the new kids on the block, or so to speak, we know less about them. We don't know as much about how the interactions with them occurred. It is a really fascinating question to consider how our species interacted and how that interaction impacts us today. I mean, we talk about, you know, how we can trace genetic combination from human beings today back to these minglings of humans and Neanderthals, or humans and Devonians.
It also makes sense in another way, now that I think about it a bit more, that, you know, in order for a new species to expand its territory, there usually needs to be sort of a hole in the ecosystem, right? I mean, there needs to be a niche for it to move into. So if the Neanderthals were dying off, the sort of ape proto-human niche in that particular ecosystem would be left open, and that would actually make it easier for Homo sapien to move in. I mean, one of the other mysteries about humanity is how quickly we just spread across the whole planet. And if our radiation out of Africa was sort of helped by the fact that there was this coincide extinction of Neanderthals and its brethren, which provided ready-made environmental niches for us, that might help explain why that occurred as well.
Yeah, and definitely because of the interaction as well, too. I mean, you know, human beings and our cousins were probably unique amongst the animal kingdom in that we were really probably capable of learning from each other. And, you know, if whatever we want to call them, tribes of early humans would encounter tribes of Neanderthals, there's definitely, I think, reason to believe that they would have, you know, watch them hunting or watch them setting up their habitats and figure out, you know, what are the survival techniques for this area and how can we outcompete these Neanderthals, or how could the Neanderthals outcompete these invading human beings? So, I mean, they definitely would have learned from each other as well. And that's really fascinating as well, because maybe they didn't just learn survival techniques, maybe they learned things like culture as well. And that's really fascinating when you think about it.
Once we come back from this break, maybe one of the other things that they learned is how to swim, or better, how to be seafarers.
Ooh, I'm intrigued.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts downtown at
212 Productions, Beat Street Records, Blim, Dream Apparel, The Fall Tattooing, The Kiss Store, Heart and Soul Clothing Inc., Hits Boutique, Pacific Cinema Tech, Project Space, Scratch Records, Vinyl Records, Woo Vintage, The Zoo Shop, and across the bridge, North Vancouver Music Gallery.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus, or check us out online at citr.ca.
And we're back on Radio Freethinker, and we're talking about Neanderthals and all the interesting ideas that are going on right now about our cousins from the past. And it looks like Neanderthals may have another reason to have spotlight shined upon them. They may have beaten humans to the seas. There's growing evidence to suggest that our cousins were accomplished sea travelers. They may have crisscrossed the Mediterranean in boats from 100,000 years ago. Now, not everybody agrees with this theory yet, but there's some interesting evidence that's emerging.
So how exactly did they get around?
Well, we know that they lived around the Mediterranean about 300,000 years ago. Now, we've found their sort of distinctive stone tools on the Greek mainland and, you know, around the Mediterranean, but they've also been found on Greek islands. Now, there's two explanations for this, of course, right? One is that Neanderthals somehow managed to get across the sea to these islands. The other explanation is that maybe these islands weren't islands back then. Maybe there were land bridges or something that was connecting them.
Or maybe they're just really, really good throwers. They could have.
Yeah, they can really hurl those stone tools. Maybe there was like a Neanderthal trying to build a canoe and he like, you know, hit his thumb and was like, oh, screw this, and chucked the thing across the water. Anyway, so George Priantos of the University of Patras in Greece
says that we can now rule out the notion that the islands had some kind of land bridge to them. Now, this gets into some geography, but what they figured out was that, a long time ago, when the Ice Age was still happening and all that, the sea levels were still very deep, and that they were never shallow enough for a land bridge to go from the Greek mainland to the Greek islands. Now, despite the fact that there may have been, ice caps and all these things, he suggests that the sea levels were never lower than 120 meters. So that would imply that either the Neanderthals swam across or they built boats and sailed across. Well, not maybe sailed, but maybe, drifted across or however it is they propelled their boats. Ferentinos thinks that Neanderthals created a seafaring culture for tens of thousands of years. Now, to comparison, modern humans are thought to have taken to the seas just 50,000 years ago, and that's how we managed to reach areas like Australia. Now, the journey from the Greek mainland to the Greek islands was not terribly long, maybe 5 to 12 kilometers. But according to some scientists, Neanderthals didn't just stop there. They apparently found other similar stone tools on islands which are farther away from the mainland, like Crete. And, of course, Crete has been an island for some 5 million years. And this, of course, implies that if Neanderthals managed to get to Crete, they probably didn't swim. They probably had some pretty sophisticated boats to get there. So this implies that not only were our ancient cousins drastically affected by climate and its change, but they had an incredibly diverse form of navigating their environment. And I think this actually syncs up with our previous talk on Neanderthals. If they were sophisticated enough to navigate the waters, they were probably pretty attuned to their specific environment, that climate change would have had a huge impact on their lifestyle. And if, their sea levels were rising or lowering depending on what was happening, that would probably have a big impact on how they were able to move about their area and how they were able to survive. So I think this is pretty convincing evidence that climate change may have been what did in the Neanderthals.
It's actually also interesting that the Neanderthals themselves may not have been the first seafaring people. I did a little quick research on this, and oddly enough, on the opposite side of the planet, where the hobbits used to live, although not the hobbits themselves, in the Indonesian islands of Foros, they've discovered 1 million-year-old stone tools. Now, for those of you who are not up on your anthropology, 1 million years old predates the humans and Neanderthals and would push it back to Homo erectus. Now, I suspect of the Indonesian islands, slightly different take than you would get in the Greek ones, and also prone to typhoons and bad weather. So maybe Homo erectus were seafarers by accident, as in, they grabbed a hold of a log and the log dragged them on. We often hear about how animals can populate small islands in the middle of nowhere because they're taken in by a storm. Maybe this one that's 1 million years old is a similar thing, although I suspect the proliferation of evidence on a bunch of Greek islands that this Neanderthal discovery is different from this earlier Homo erectus tree, because it's just not one island, there are several islands that the Neanderthals have been on.
Well, yeah, I mean, and to be fair, there are people who disagree with this hypothesis. Some have suggested that some of these tools haven't been proven to have been created by Neanderthals. They simply resemble Neanderthal tools. That may be true, and maybe, and if that is true, of course, then it does throw kind of a monkey wrench into this theory. But given what we know about Neanderthals and the fact that, as you say, the hobbits on Flores were obviously able to get there, and there is considerable evidence that early seafaring was indeed possible. I don't know if it's quite enough to simply say, well, those stone tools clearly aren't Neanderthal. I think we need to see some actual documentation that proves that these tools were created at a later point and not created by our cousins from the past.
It is conceivable that these stone tools were just poorly made human tools. There is no patent law that says a human could not make a tool that resembled a Neanderthal tool. In fact, there probably was a lot of sort of stealing. But I noticed in the science article, it says that based on bathymetric and sea level changes and such, that the settlement probably was at least 110,000 years old, or at least that's when it first started showing signs of, quote, human habitation. So that would rule out the human fakiness idea. Although it doesn't rule out natural formations and such, which I guess is one of the other things they're thinking might be involved.
Again, I think it comes down to the question of just how good were the Neanderthals at creating tools and getting around. And I think that a lot of the evidence that we've seen, that we've been talking about today, and that you know have sort of been emerging over the past couple of years, indicates that they're actually pretty good at getting around. And they're not in sort of a clumsy or as primitive as maybe we thought in the past. I'm kind of leaning towards the notion that Neanderthals were a bit more sophisticated and a bit, a bit more inventive, perhaps, is the word.
Yes, I think that's a very good point.
Well, we're nearing the end of today's show. Let's go on to our skeptical highlights. Don, what skeptical highlights do you have?
I've got a trifecta this week. First of all, the SFU's Philosopher's Cafe, which is meeting at the SFU Harbor Center downtown, is going to have Michael Picard discuss questions about whether ethics can be taught and whether they can be established objectively. Now, of course, this is a topic that we've covered more than once in our show, and I'm sure it'll be a very interesting event to show up to. That's going to be on March 8th at noon. My second highlight, we've been talking a lot about media rights. We talked today about Rogers and their right to deceive, and before we had the whole lawful access bill. A lot of information about that came through a website called openmedia.ca. It boasts itself as a grassroots organization that safeguards the possibilities of open and affordable internet. They are working towards providing information and creating a participatory digital world. So you can check them out at openmedia.ca. The last one I'm going to mention is a talk going on sponsored by the UBC Freethinkers, Distrust and Anti-Atheist Prejudice, done by Will Javeris. He will be talking Thursday, March 22nd at 7 p.m. at Buchanan A101 here in Vancouver's campus at UBC. Ethan, do you have any highlights?
I do. I have two things I want to cast some skeptical attention towards. The first one is a couple of atheist banners that are going up in the United States. These two banners are a bit different than your typical ones. They're being put up by the worthy organization, American Atheists. These two banners are actually going to be written in Hebrew as well as Arabic. These two banners say, you know it's a myth and you have a choice. Each one, depending on, it's going to be placed in a certain location close to either a synagogue or mosque, and it's designed to help give closeted atheists inside these communities, whether they're Muslim or Jewish, the notion that you're not alone and that there are other free thinkers out there, and that if you want to reach out to them, they're happy to talk to you and to encourage your journey to free thought. No doubt these banners, despite the fact that they say very little that can be deemed offensive, will most likely draw significant controversy. So it'll be interesting to see what the response is from the local communities.
The billboards will go up in New York and New Jersey. So if you're in those areas, keep an eye out for them. Keep an eye out for what kind of response they gather from the local community.
Ethan, do you know if they're going to be bilingual or are they just going to be in Hebrew or Arabic?
They are bilingual. So they say in English and Arabic, as well as English and Hebrew. So both languages are represented. If you can go to our website, www.radiofreethinker, and we will have links, and you can look at the banners themselves. They're, very nice looking, and they do actually have a very nice flair that makes them look, very culturally appropriate to their chosen demographics. So it should be very interesting to see. The other skeptical highlight I have is another talk by the UBC Freethinkers. This one is called What I Learned at Strike Camp with Ted Cox. This is a free lecture. It's happening Thursday, March 15th at 7 p.m. in Buchanan Room A103. The talk is co-sponsored by the UBC Freethinkers and the Pride UBC and the Secular Student Alliance. Ted Cox will be traveling from Seattle to give a lecture on What I Learned at Strike Camp. Ted is an ex-Mormon who turned atheist and went undercover as a participant in Christian gay to straight programs. He is an award-winning journalist who frequently covers religion and has caught the attention of Fox News Radio, The Huffington Post, NPR, as well as other news agencies. So it sounds like a great lecture. It's free and a great opportunity to get some more free thought going here in Vancouver. Well, we're out of time here on the show. This is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
And this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Freethinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy runs. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The horizon of the Milky Way cosmos is full.